The following Aloud podcast was recorded live in 2008 at the historic Central Library in the heart of downtown LA as part of the award-winning Aloud series presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Aloud podcasts are made possible through the generosity of the law firm Arent Fox and by individual contributions from listeners like you. For more information on Aloud, or to find out how you, too, can support the Los Angeles Public Library, please visit our website, www.aloudla.org. I know that many of you are trying to find ways or already participating in this year's election process. Tonight, Naomi Wolf speaks about her new book, Give Me Liberty, A Handbook for American Revolutionaries, which details practical ways to reject the status quo and foment change through direct political action. Naomi Wolf is a California native. She's from San Francisco originally. She did her undergraduate work at Yale and her graduate work at Oxford University as a Rhodes Scholar. Her essays have appeared in many publications, including The New Republic, The Wall Street Journal, The Washington Post, and The New York Times, and she blogs for The Huffington Post. She made a sensation with her landmark international bestseller, The Beauty Myth, in 1991. She is the author of six other books, including the New York Times bestselling The End of America, Letter of Warning to a Young Patriot, in which she outlines what she calls 10 steps to fascism, citing historical corollaries and pointing out that fascism can exist without dictatorship. Ms. Wolf, wrote Wes Boyd, reminds us that we must recommit ourselves to the fundamental American idea that no president, whether Democrat or Republican, will ever be given unchecked power. She is the co-founder and president of the Woodhull Institute for Ethical Leadership, an organization devoted to training young women in ethical leadership for the 21st century, and co-founder of the American Freedom Campaign, an American movement for democracy and the rule of law. And in conversation with Naomi tonight is Martin Kaplan, the director of the Norman Lear Center. He's associate dean of the USC Annenberg School for Communication and a USC Annenberg research professor. Marty is a man who definitely knows his way around politics. He's been a White House speechwriter, a Washington journalist, a deputy presidential campaign manager, a Disney studio executive, a motion picture and television producer and screenwriter, a radio host, and also a blogger. Please welcome Martin Kaplan and Naomi Wolf. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Louise, and thanks to all of you for being here, and above all, thank you, Naomi, for coming to L.A.
Thank you, Marty. I'm delighted to be here.
So we're going to talk about a lot of different things, but because there's so much in the news to talk about, I wanted to be sure that we at least spent some time talking about your book.
Please.
Okay. So I'm going to read just a sentence and ask you to tell me and tell everyone here how this came to be.
Okay.
I found myself sitting crumpled on the floor between a TGI Fridays and a world's best yogurt at Newark Airport, literally crying on the phone to a friend. How'd you get there?
That's such a great question. I guess the background, I should tell you the background.
That's why I asked.
That was
my drug addiction.
It was my heartbroken, you know, my bad boyfriend. No, I'm just kidding. It was the state of our democracy that led me to be crumpled on the floor at Newark. At that point, I had gone on this journey. It began when, is it okay if I address the audience as well as you?
Absolutely.
Thank you. It began when I had traveled around the country speaking to audiences of all kinds of people, all kinds of backgrounds and political persuasions about the threat that Marty mentioned that I described in my last book, The End of America, which does in fact argue very distressingly that there are these 10 recognizable steps that would-be dictators always take when they're closing down an open society or crushing a democracy movement, that we're seeing them in America. And so understandably, people said, well, you know, what's the answer? This is the problem. We believe you. What's the answer? So this book is intended to offer the answer. And so in order to give the people of the United States who are asking me this, the answer, I went back to the founders to, and I don't just mean the well-known white male founders, I mean that whole founding generation, which we're not often taught about, the ordinary people, the farmers and artisans and washerwomen and working people and enslaved African Americans who all had this vision of liberty. They were all captivated by this ideal. And I wanted to go back to what these heroic Americans meant us to have, to receive about the American ideal, these core values, because I felt that we were part of how we're being manipulated is we're being made to forget, we're being propagandized to forget these core values. But I also, you know, so I was reading Jefferson, and I was reading the Declaration of Independence, among other things, and it is categorical that one of the core values is that ordinary people are supposed to run things. No question. And so, and that you have an obligation to speak out, and that you have an obligation to stand up against tyranny and oppression. These are three core values. So I took this seriously, and I went on this journey of trying to actually use my rights and serve as a citizen leader the way we're all supposed to do. And it was this appalling kind of Alice in Wonderland-like journey because I couldn't do it. I realized that there's like this, what I call fake democracy. There's fake patriotism and fake democracy. And so when I tried to exert my rights and my authority as an American, not just, you know, vote and email your congressman, which is the way we've been brainwashed to think is the scope of our citizenship as Americans. It's not true. That's a tiny fraction of what we're supposed to be doing in leading the nation. But I tried, for instance, to you know, hold a rally in Union Square and use my First Amendment rights to talk about the Constitution, the threats to the Constitution. And I found out that it was illegal for me to hold that rally because it was illegal for me to use a bullhorn.
You need a permit.
I had to get a permit, that's right. And then I tried to get a friend, help a friend run for Senate in Virginia. Wonderful guy, you know, primary school teacher, would have been a great senator. And two or three clicks into the process, I realized that the crucial information you need in order to file to run for senator is written in Latin. Right? Meaning it's in this dense bureaucraties, legalese, that there's no translation for. I mean, you need the legalities. It's about, you know, campaign finance issues, but no translation, no indication of where you can find a translator, no access for an ordinary person, a non-insider. And then I found out, you know, I went to all these websites like, well, this made me really mad. I'm going to see what they do in Atlanta. I'm going to see what they do in, you know, Minnesota. And I found out that again and again, you would get these websites purporting to be a gateway into your government, which you're supposed to be leading. And it would be this fake portal. You know, like in Atlanta, you go to the city council page, and by the way, no one tells you how to run. I mean, it was hell on earth trying to find out how to run for office. And you and I are supposed to be running for office and leading the country. But in Atlanta, you get 500 characters to submit to, if you want to serve on a commission, not words, characters, that's letters, right? And then it goes into this black hole. They don't tell you who's reading it, when you're going to hear back, what the, you know, qualifications are. Fake democracy. You know, I thought about registering people to vote, and then I found out that you can be fined $5,000 if you make a single, like, bureaucratic mistake because there's this assault on voting rights, you know, like the cost of a used car, you know, and I can't spare $5,000, you know, if I'm going to register my fellow citizens to vote. And, you know, again and again, just this brick wall, pretending to be democracy. And, you know, then I interviewed Curtis Ellis, who's a source of mine, who works on Capitol Hill, and he showed me how the sausage is made. And it was absolutely horrifying because to be a congressperson, and he helps ordinary people run for Congress, you have to spend 4 hours a day on the phone, not just during your campaign, while you're governing, while you're serving, raising money.
And the money is for?
Ads.
Paid ads.
Paid ads.
On the media that we own.
Exactly right. So the good news is there are solutions to all of this that I give you in the last third of the book. But the bad news is that you know, there's this whole infested, corrupted accretion of truly I had to face this. It's not casual. It's not informal. It's not just bureaucracy. It's not just bad management. It's a deliberate effort, a 30-year systemic effort since the last time citizens actually rised up effectively in the late 60s and early 70s, systematic effort to pretend that all is well, to pretend that we're the greatest democracy on earth, but actually to close us out, strip us of scope, narrow our space for protest, narrow our space to exert our power. And it made me really mad. It was like, but also heartbroken. I mean, that's why I was crying, because it was like this beautiful thing that I believed in. I was, someone had dropped the scrim, and I was seeing like rats scurrying around in the theater.
Well, it wasn't an accident that you believed in this stuff. You found it in the Latin, in effect, of the Declaration of Independence. Your reading of the Declaration includes a kind of translation into plain talk. And the key to your translation, as I understand it, is our responsibilities. Talk about what we're supposed to do.
Thank you. I have to say, I love your questions. It's just such a relief because I'm on tour. what did he do?
Gestured.
I'm on a book tour, and one of the things that's driving me crazy since I've had this kind of conversion experience with Jefferson and all these amazing founders, well-known and unknown, is that I'm aware of the way things should be in a new way, and so one reason I'm loving your questions and the chance we have to really have a real conversation is that I've been trying to communicate these ideas in like 4-minute segments on breakfast television.
I'm sorry, our time is up.
And now the commercial break, right? So you're quite right. How many here know the phrase life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness from the Declaration of Independence? Absolutely everybody. And who here was taught in middle school or high school or college that the Declaration of Independence also commits you to serve as a revolutionary fighting against oppression every single day of your life? 2. Okay, so many fewer. You had great teachers, by the way. So I, too, had learned life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness as sort of the main message of the Declaration of Independence. But what I learned going deeper into these documents is that, you know, fake patriotism, what we're told about our core documents and core values is, I'm not allowed to swear, am I? It's very wrong, right? and so we're even... you know, sort of told that this whole phrase, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, sort of means, you know, let's all get along, I'll give you space, you give me space, you know, I'll be a soccer mom, you be a goth, you know, and it's okay. And, you know, we'll all just shop together, right? And in fact, first of all, it doesn't even mean that. In the 18th century, happiness meant something very different. It meant using your faculties as a free man or woman to the utmost in a context that you could be of service to the larger, to the greater good. Very different definition, I know. But the second paragraph, you're never taught the second paragraph. And, you know, one thing that blew my mind about these documents is that nobody translates them. I have a doctorate. No, I don't. That was a Freudian slip. I almost qualified for a doctorate, and my grandma's still waiting, right? But in English literature from Oxford. And so I should be able to understand this language, but I can't, right? It's very dense 18th century language. And nobody, where can you find a user's guide to the Constitution, the Bill of Rights, the Declaration of Independence? I couldn't find one, so I provide them. I got, you know, translations of them. But the second paragraph of the Declaration of Independence says, it is your job as an American always, always to rise up against tyranny and oppression. That's your commitment. And it says that being an American is not all the ideals say this. It's not a place you live. It's not even a system of government. It's a psychological state that you carry here and here. And it's a commitment to freedom, and it's a willingness to risk everything in defense of freedom. always, every day. You don't get a break. Jefferson does not, you know, give you a loophole, a commitment to be a radical fighter for freedom all the time. I didn't get that in, you know, AP history. So that is the answer to what I learned from the Declaration.
It wasn't on the test.
It wasn't. They skipped it.
So we have a responsibility to rise up and be in a state of perpetual revolution, but you don't want...
Not always. Only if government, for instance, subverts the will of the people.
But you don't want us to end up crumpled on the floor of Newark Airport crying. You want to equip us with skills and tools to do this. Why don't you describe the second half of the book?
I will, but before I do, I guess I have to really be honest with the audience and say part of me does want people to be crumpled on the floor crying because it is very, very heartbreaking and very, very wrong the way we've been manipulated and deceived and the threats that are being directed against us in this ideal, even as we sit here. And part of the process of truly reclaiming liberty starts with facing what's happened. And there is grief and there is pain in confronting and letting the scales fall from our eyes. But I have to say, I'm very impressed with Americans because, you know, I've been bringing this very, you know, this is a very hopeful message, but the last book is a very dark message about the threats to freedom. And I keep expecting people to say, oh, come on, Naomi, you know, lighten up. But Americans, you know, at a grassroots level are much, much more willing to be very courageous in confronting, you know, real dark truths than, for instance, people in the media bubble or in the political bubble. But yes, you're quite right. I, you know, did have a mission from all the, you know, readers and just citizens who said, what do we do to provide deliverables? So part of what I offer, I know, is psychological, that a chance to reconnect with those core ideals because you need courage. You need the courage that gives you, and you need the self-regard and sense of dignity that gives you. Because one thing I really found traveling the country is that Americans feel very beaten down, very passive, very hopeless and powerless. Paradoxically, the Americans I met on this journey in relation to these issues of taking control of the country again feel more powerless than citizens I met in Sierra Leone, which is one of the poorest countries on earth and a baby, newly hatched democracy. But apart from the psychological you know, gifts of the founders that I hope to give people, I definitely needed to deliver the how-to. And I also found that that's something that I couldn't find anywhere. You know, a lot of people are complaining about what's going on, but, you know, the what do we do is missing.
So how to what?
How to form yourselves into what we call democracy commando teams, meaning...
you get to wear camo?
If you want to, although that's getting problematic these days. You organize yourselves into groups of 20 or 30, that few can have an impact. You register one another to vote, you can name your group, and there are simple things that you can do as a group of friends, fellow citizens, involving how to relate to your representative, how to paradoxically get the word out for your representative. That gives you enormous power, more power than the special interests, in terms of getting your representative to respond to you and to deliver the kind of legislation that you want. Paradoxically, why? What are they raising all this money for? Ads to persuade you, to get you to vote for them. So if you can say, I've got 30 people in my democracy team and I've got, you know, 100 people on my Facebook page, and I've told them, I've gotten out the vote for you in this way, I've helped you in this way, you call the district office and you're a major power broker. I couldn't believe this when I was told it by Curtis Ellis, but, you know, it's true. But much more urgently, you know, I teach people, for instance, track the mainstream media, but give it no more authority because it's bankrupt. And so rather than just blogging, which I think is not taking yourself seriously enough, just offering your opinions or complaining about the mainstream media, I teach people to become the media. How to write an op-ed. We were talking about that earlier. How to place an op-ed. How to, you're going to get called for television then and radio. How to communicate about your issue on television, on radio. How to leak abuses to a reporter. What's on background, off background, off, I'm sorry, on background, sorry, on the record, off the record, on background. How to do a feature. How to frame the news. How to engage in the debate. I teach people to stop leaving the fake debates, and I participate in these fake debates, and I'm happy to tell you how very fake they are, on television, you know, the guy on the left, the woman on the right, or vice versa. These are not debates, and I've got this chapter on deliberation. The founders intended for you guys to be having the debates, for you guys to be sitting face to face with your neighbors, especially your neighbors with whom you disagree, and for you all to be debating the issues of the day and working out policy prescriptions and points of view. So how to hold a citywide town meeting, how to get the candidates to respond to your questions in a citywide town meeting, how to fundraise for your political campaign, how to start a political campaign, how to document government abuses, how to hold a protest march, how to safely protest. I've got a chapter on protest and how the kind of protest that brings down tyrants always, historically, is now illegal in the United States. How to be safe when you're protesting now that Homeland Security is essentially arming the police forces against
citizens. We're
going
to come back to that.
Yeah, so many, many of these how-tos.
In the course of recommending things, as well as teaching people things, you say warm words about the idea of a national referendum. We in California have a certain amount of experience with the upsides and the downsides of initiatives and referenda.
Yes.
Why are you so sanguine about direct democracy?
Right. Well, you're right that it definitely has pluses and minuses. I grew up in San Francisco, so I know this is, I mean, that's why I thought so hard about referenda. I saw the crazy people trying to get the, you know, gay people out of the schools. And a very formative experience for me, and one that probably made me think hard about what fascism can do in a democracy is, what was it called, Prop 9, Prop 13, the get the gay people out of the schools thing, that crazy fruit woman, you know, the grapefruit woman?
Anita Bryant.
Anita Bryant, right. Thank you. Yeah, thank you. Just blocked her name. But orange juice, thank you, not grapefruit juice. she was backed by these powerful interests, and I remember it was a census year, and I was making extra money as a high school student working for the census, and this debate was going on. Are we going to pass Prop 13, was it? 6, the anti-gay measure. And I had paradoxically, I think it was a civics teacher who was gay. I didn't really know that because at that point it wasn't educational issue, what your teacher's sexual orientation was. But I was knocking on people's doors and filling out the census form. And I knocked on his door by accident, and he opened the door, and his boyfriend was in the background. And I was just going through asking the questions, and I felt the fear. I felt the fear that the state could ask a question that would lose this guy his job. And he was right to feel that fear, and I never forgot, you know, the difference. You know, Sharansky talks about the difference between a fear society and a free society, and how easy it is, you know, if we're not careful, to become a fear society.
So given that, why confidence
why
in
the
a
confidence?
Referendum?
Because right now, I'm absolutely, and news events of the last few weeks have made this clearer than ever, convinced that our republic is broken. Our representatives cannot represent us even if they want to because of the stranglehold of the special interests. Left or right, it doesn't matter. And that at this point, sending emails and voting and even organizing to our utmost is not going to give us the tools to radically change the chessboard so that the people have the power again. And while crazy citizens can use, you know, organizations with lots of money to try to persuade citizens to vote for this or that referendum, and that's a danger, I would rather it was the voters being lobbied than the representatives. Because limited direct democracy. What I did learn is this. Studies show, there's something called there's a direct democracy movement. And studies show that when you don't just throw people a referendum, but you give the citizens a chance to own the issue and deliberate about the issue, and there are very developed ways to do this, people's understanding of the issue skyrockets. Their willingness to take ownership of the solution skyrockets. Like, people are more willing to cap emissions, even if it means they're, you know, they have to pay more in electricity bills or whatever. And their knowledge of the political process and stakes involved goes up, and their understanding of what they're doing. They educate each other. And so, you know, there's some critical examples of places where direct democracy is very, very, very effective. And no one teaches us about this. All over Northern Europe, the whole European Union has referenda. And, you know, people are still free in Sweden, right? And Switzerland has had referenda, direct democracy, for 600 years. And when a crazy person says, let's get a law on the books in Switzerland to out the immigrants and send them home if we don't like them, overwhelmingly, the non-crazy people prevail. So on balance, the people given the tools to legislate in a real democracy are more trustworthy than our congressional representatives, who at this point are in the pocket of the special interest and never going to be getting out. So there are two issues I want you to think about. 70%, and finally, Abraham Lincoln wanted a national referendum on slavery. So right now, 70% of Americans, it's not even a partisan issue, want an end to the Iraq War. But Boeing and Raytheon and Halliburton and KBR want the war to go on forever. The people have no power compared to these interests. In a national referendum, 70% of people could end the war tomorrow. And again, campaign finance and caps on emissions. There is no reason for these people ever to engage in campaign finance reform. And there is no reason, given that their funders are the gas and oil industries, there is no reason for them to ever invest seriously in alternative energy to save us from global warming. So if we ever want to save ourselves from the outcome of global warming, we're going to need this kind of legislative option. And the founders gave it to us. They gave us the wherewithal to amend the Constitution to create limited national referenda, direct democracy.
I'm going to quote a passage from your book as a way to pivot from your book to what's been going on since you wrote it. So the war is upon us. These subversions of our liberties, now institutionalized forever, no matter which party leads the nation, unless we say no. No candidate on either side is seriously talking about fighting the war to restore liberty.
That, unfortunately, is true. Do you want me to elaborate on that?
Yes.
Okay. All right. Well, for those of you who are not familiar with the argument in The End of America, which this is a response to, very briefly, you know, what I said is, if you look at any of the closing societies in history, originating with Mussolini, who was this great satanic innovator of these technologies of closing democracy, Hitler's Germany, the early years. Remember, Germany was a parliamentary democracy in 1930, 31, 32. It had a free press. It had, you know, many political parties. It had women's rights organizations, gay rights organizations, Paris fashion, Bauhaus architecture, celebrities, and a small group of people used what Mussolini had pioneered. Small group of people used the law to subvert the law, ushering in the door to come. So many parallels. And I looked at Stalin's Russia, East Germany in the 50s, Czechoslovakia in the 60s, Pinochet's coup in Chile in 73, and the crackdown in China in the end of the 80s. And what you see is this blueprint, always the same 10 steps. Invoke a terrifying internal and external threat. Create a secret prison system where torture takes place, or unaccountable to the rule of law prison system where torture is institutionalized. Create a paramilitary force, not answerable to the people. Create a surveillance apparatus. Start to infiltrate citizens' groups. Start to target key individuals. Start to restrict the press. I mean, I can give you, you know, and the last step is the subversion of the rule of law, or making it easier to declare martial law. And I need to talk about that at some point, because of events of the last week and a half. But what I saw was that these are happening here, that the t- the hour is very late, later in the last week and a half than, I mean, so late that we have to, you know, recognize that we're in a state of emergency. And what I realized is that given the tangle of vested interests who don't want the Constitution to be viable, and given the influence they have over both candidates, and I'm an Obama supporter, I've said that, because he at least is ideologically committed to restoring liberty, and he at least is not actively committed to a violent coup like the opposition, and I'll defend what I just said, if you like, shortly. But even if we get him in power, or either of them in power, first of all, history shows that any leader of any political party is going to be tempted to abuse these powers. I mean, it's just, democracy is hard. You know, if you, it's hard to get 53% or 52% of people to support you. It's easy if you're, even if you're Barack Obama, it's much easier to just, you know, intimidate the Republican protesters or, you know, put Matt Drudge in prison for 3 years or use surveillance to read the, I know. Let's not go there. But your surveillance tools to read the strategy memos of the challenger while it's still in the computer. The founders knew, this is why we have these checks and balances that are being subverted. The founders knew that any leader, any faction, anyone would abuse power if it's unchecked. The other thing I mentioned is that, like, why are we in this assault on liberty? Because billions of dollars in profit is generated by it. Billions. And these people don't want the Constitution to function. There are billions of dollars to be made from a police state in the United States, just like they're investing in the technologies for a police state in China, you know, police states all over the world. And I'll tell you what I mean. At the end of the Cold War, the third of the economy that was devoted to Cold War weapon systems was facing a declining market share because they didn't have a global enemy. And so they needed a global enemy. Hence, you get this hyped war on terror. There are terrorists, but our allies around the world, England and Spain, fight terrorists, but they don't engage in a wholesale crackdown on their own citizens, right? They say it's a crime, not a cause. And you, these Boeing and Raytheon, these weapons manufacturers have shifted into surveillance and security technologies. And their lobbyists are sitting down with Homeland Security officials and writing the laws. And that is not going to change in any administration unless the people rise up, unless we rise up. So what I'm saying is, even if you elect, we have to stop thinking these people are going to fix it. That's the thing I need you to leave here knowing. We have to stop being passive. Whoever is in charge, it is up to us. It is up to us. Obama can only restore the Constitution if there is a vigorous, aggressive, empowered grassroots democracy movement of us holding his feet to the fire. And finally, how do I know? Thank you. Thank you. Part of how I can say that with such confidence is that I have worked on two presidential campaigns, not doing fashion consulting, in spite of the RNC's very clever urban legends. I was working on women's issues. But working with, for instance, Al Gore up close, Al Gore is a good man, and he wanted, for instance, to give the women of America and the men who are dads good work family policies. But he couldn't do it without us because he was up against the business interests and the chambers of commerce, and it was expensive for them to give women and men a chance to raise their families properly. But the moms of America aren't a lobby. We're not organizing. So he couldn't go to them and say, look, Biff, you know, I'd love to, you know, do what you want, but look, I've got 30 million furious organized moms who will not let me do that, right? Because, you know, we're encouraged in America to complain rather than to organize or to see it as our own personal problem. So this is why Obama needs us, or whoever is in power needs us, to demand the restoration of the Constitution, because it does not have friends right now. It has enemies.
As a way of turning to what's been going on in these last few days that you've alluded to, I want to quote from something you wrote in a blog that's circulating. McCain doesn't matter. I believe the Rove Cheney cabal is using Sarah Palin as a stalking horse, an Evita figure, to put a popular populist face on the coming police state and be the talk show hostess for the end of elections as we know them. Am I trying to scare you? I am. I am trying to scare you to death and ask you to scare your Republican and independent friends most of all. So scare us.
Well, aren't you scared already? No, I'm happy to scare you further, so I'll have company. But also so we can take up arms properly, and I mean that metaphorically. Okay, what I was arguing there, again, this theme of don't leave it to the election to fix things. And we have to get to whether or not there's going to be an election at some point. But what I was arguing there is that to my eye, that's very, very familiar from the 2000 campaign with the fingerprints of the Bush team and their speechwriters and their stylists and their and Rove, it seemed clear to me that Sarah Palin was working for Karl Rove and not for John McCain. And this was everything from the fact that she was using the same... you were a speechwriter for... a presidential candidate, you know how signature these phrases are. She was using George Bush's speechwriter's phrasing from 2000. She was surrounded by Rove operatives and aides who were orchestrating her every move. And I noticed that she was carrying water for policies that John McCain doesn't agree with. She was recycling the lie that Bush used to lead us into a war of choice in which 4,000 brave young men and women are now dead and over 100,000 Iraqis, when she linked 9/11 falsely to Iraq, right? I mean, John McCain never did that. He never did that. I mean, he actually used to be a decent guy, and he probably is sorry he's selling his soul right now. He never told that lie. And she also mocked Barack Obama for wanting to give the detainees the rights that the founders intended for everyone arrested by the United States of America to have, that John Adams risked his career to give some of the most hated people at his time, the Redcoats responsible for the Boston Massacre. And she made fun of that. Now, John McCain is a war criminal. What a slip. God.
Did you get your doctorate?
No, obviously not. Nope. he is a war prisoner. He was a war prisoner, prisoner of war, and he was tortured. So he wrote this very eloquent essay in 2005 in Newsweek criticizing the Bush team for torture, although he's now horrifically, you know, supported the 2006 law that allows torture. But you know, these are not his policies. And so I realized, I thought about, well, what happens in a closing society? According to the blueprint, you know, dictators love elections. We have this false idea of what a dictatorship looks like. We think there are no newspapers, there's no judiciary, there's just boots in the street. It's not true. All over the world, there are dictatorships that hold elections, that have a judiciary, that have a press. What they don't have is freedom. And everybody who works in those organizations knows how far they can go. And what they'll do is hold elections. Dictators love elections, but they'll make sure that the elections are corrupted. Massive documentation of Republican vote suppression, vote fraud. And they'll make sure that their guy or gal gets in, ideally a weak figurehead who's telegenic but doesn't have a power base of his or her own, that is a front person for the same cabal continuing in power. So why do I say the end of elections as we know them? And by the way, you know, Sarah Palin, you know, the Palins are defying subpoenas right now. You know, she does not have a giant reverence for the rule of law. She is known for intimidating her opposition, her critics. People are scared to speak up about Sarah Palin in Alaska because of repercussions. So my calculation is this, and this is hard to talk about, but we have to. John McCain has a very serious form of skin cancer. And dermatologists are now beginning to speak openly about the fact that actuarial tables show that someone of his, with his illness at his age, has about a 2 to 4 year survival rate. So my analysis is that Rove and Cheney, with their demonic brilliance, are calculating that there's going to be a Palin presidency, if not later than sooner, and they're ready for a decade, you know, perhaps, of President Palin, during which time these subversions of liberty can become institutionalized. FISA alone, the waiving of the Fourth Amendment alone, the surveillance issue alone, means that if it's not retracted, it won't be under a Palin presidency, every president forever, every team in power forever can read the strategy memos of the opposition, their data, their focus groups, their sound bites, their speeches, while they are in the computer. Not to mention, think about this, why is this Congress so passive? The thing about surveillance is, when you have a surveillance apparatus, you know everybody's secrets. The Stasi did this. This is why surveillance works so well. If everybody has something they talk on the phone about or write emails about that they don't want known. You know, I'm bisexual. I had an affair. I have an addiction. I have a bipolar illness.
I read Drudge.
Or whatever, right? Right. And all these people sitting in Congress, all their secrets are in the hands of the opposition. It's just been confirmed by Mark Crispin Miller at NYU that Republican staffers in the Justice Department hacked Congress's computers, and all their secrets are in their hands. This is not going away. And so how are you going to have a real election?
Well, the stuff that I've heard you say and write about in the last 10 days, you think this is ratcheted up considerably.
Yes. I mean, I'm actively terrified right now.
And what are the specific triggers that make you feel that way?
Okay. Well, first, for a couple of weeks now, as I've been traveling the country, I've been hearing from many, many citizens that harassment and intimidation of citizens is being ratcheted up substantially. So, and not just activists on the left, but libertarians, people on the right, everything from mail tampering, which I experience, which is quite disturbing. You know, my tax returns vanishing, my mail comes ripped open, just ripped open in a way that the post office says it's not possible.
Stasi did it better than that.
Well, you know, what's the point? Is the point reading the mail? I don't have very interesting mail. My readers know that I deliberately tell all my secrets so that they can never be used against me. No, if you're messaging, if you're, you know, freaking people out, you know, you let them know that, you know, they can tamper with your personal possessions in that way. I have no evidence, you know, at all. I'm just reporting what's happening. But that's the least of it. I mean, this young woman who protested, I'm hearing about people's homes being broken into and nothing being taken. I'm hearing about people's electronic hacking. You know, people have to keep closing their email accounts and opening new ones. This has happened to people working on projects that, you know, the freedom campaigns and so on are involved with. In ways that kind of don't make sense as just like bad technology. So that's disturbing. I mean, at the RNC, you know, Ron Paul supporters were surrounded by the Secret Service and had their possessions confiscated and were, you know, intimidated and bullied. They're under constant surveillance. These are, these are libertarians. And, you know, language is changing in the law. I predicted this, not that I'm so smart, but that the blueprint is so predictive. I predicted last fall that you'd start to see about now mass arrests. Did we have mass arrests? You'd start to see journalists being arrested. Dozens of journalists were arrested at the RNC. You would start to see the laws that expanded the definition of terrorist so that you would start to see people called terrorists who look like the boy or girl next door. And in Chicago, I met a young man named Ian Bicking who was trembling because his sister, Monica Bicking, young American, you know, citizen who protested, is one of the RNC 8 and has been charged as a terrorist. And she's facing $250,000 in legal fees and, you know, years of her life, even if she gets an acquittal. So that was scaring me because it had gone as it does in Closing Society, from being like verbal or theoretical or I'm on the watch list, ha, 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 sort of, you know, which is the worst it got last fall, to this more direct kind of intervention. But in the last week and a half, I'm sorry to be the messenger for this, but you have to know, the Army Times reported, you know, step 10 is subverting the rule of law and make it easier to declare martial law. And in step 10, you often see boots on the street. And this is why I was so disturbed by the rise of Blackwater. But enough citizens have spoken up about and been alerted to the threat of Blackwater, establishing bases in North Carolina, in Illinois, in trying to get into San Diego, that I don't think they're a reliable mercenary force. The 1st Brigade of the 3rd Infantry Division has been deployed as of October 1st in the United States of America. And, okay, I'm going to say this more gently because it's really important for us to not freak out and just to stay very centered because there are many things we can do. They are in training exercises somewhere. I heard from the brother of one of the soldiers in Seattle that they're currently in training. Their mission, their stated mission, is crowd control. They're using the technologies of crowd control that they used in Iraq, including tasers and rubber bullets. Tasers have killed 300 people, and rubber bullets have been lethal in the UK, so much so that they've stopped using them there. But Amy Goodman also reported that they have lethal technologies and tanks. So bringing this full circle, I mean, first, if you follow the legal chain of implication of the 1st Brigade being deployed, the White House has set up various laws that have changed things like Posse Comitatus and the Insurrection Act, which protected us from military being deployed in our streets, so that who does the 1st Brigade have to obey? Does anyone know? Exactly. It's not Congress. It's not the people. They have to obey the executive. And if they disobey an order from the president, they're facing 5 years. They're facing arrest and prosecution. And all, this is all the way up the chain of command. So I did a terrifying blog post, terrifying to me, in which I called Colonel Antoon, who's a source of mine, a patriot, who was in the military. And I asked him, well, does the 1st Brigade, you know, if the president tells the 1st Brigade to arrest Congress, what happens? And he said, they have to do it. And I said, well, does the 1st Brigade, you know, if the president tells the 1st Brigade to shoot at civilians, what happens? And he said, they have to do it. If the 1st, you know, what recourse does Congress have if the 1st Brigade is sent to arrest them? You know, none. They have to throw themselves on the mercy of the military. And if the military speak up for them, they can be arrested.
Let me just interrupt at that point. I know you have one other point to make.
Yeah.
I've read the piece from Army Times, and you're quite right. It does say that their mission is an on-call federal response for natural or man-made emergencies and disasters, including terrorist attacks. They may be called upon to help with civil unrest and crowd control. So that is there. My question is, let me just push back to be sure I understand you.
Please.
Do you think that what you just described might happen?
Let me put it this way. I've studied a lot of closing societies. You cannot name a society in which the leader federalizes troops and sends them into civilian streets where good things happened. And I also want to note to you, and I'm sorry to do this, but this is how we're going to survive and transcend this crisis. We have to change our habits of thinking. In a democracy, you'd think, ha, 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 you know, of course the military might be called in by these well-meaning public servants to help, for instance, in Katrina, when they were called in that Rovian way as trial balloons or to make it a precedent. But these people, would I ever have thought that the United States Commander-in-Chief would defy domestic and international law and set up the systematic torture and sexual abuse of prisoners in custody? You know, if you were to tell me that, I would think that was crazy. You know, would I ever think that the president would systematically subvert the Constitution and set up law after law after law, giving him powers that the founders never intended him to have? No. You know, would I ever think that in a country that we were occupying, it would be a matter of policy for these same soldiers, good young men and women sent to carry out monstrous orders as a matter of policy to torture, as a matter of policy to arrest, to essentially kidnap. They kidnap the husbands and wives of alleged insurgents and hold them as a way to pressure these Iraqi citizens to turn themselves in. As a matter of policy. I mean, so we have to get out of the habit of, oh, this is ridiculous. This will never happen in America. Things that should never have happened in America have happened. And it's frankly denial for us to think the president has set up all these powers and he's got, you know, the last thing in a police state is troops under the command of a leader. And it is foolish of us to assume that nothing will be done to subdue citizens. Now, just let me finish. I'm sorry, but also, what is the definition of a police state? I mean, what I've been saying in the blog that you're going to see on tomorrow is that the coup has taken place, because the definition of a police state is when the leader has his own military, her own military, and his own treasury, or her own treasury. And let me call your attention to the way President Bush handled the economic disaster. Remember those speeches? That speech he gave, was it FDR in a crisis? There's nothing to fear but fear itself. Let's stabilize the markets. We're going to get through this. Or was he saying, this is a catastrophe. It's going to get worse. It's coming to a bank near you. It's going to get you. Be as afraid as you can. That is the language from an executive that is going to do exactly what it did, drive the, you know, Dow Jones another 800 points in a day. And if you look at history, what happened in Germany? Economic crisis, economic stability, state of emergency. What happened in Italy? Economic crisis, economic instability. And finally, very disturbingly, I'll give you two more pieces of the puzzle. In Germany, Chancellor Merkel called out the troops as a precaution because of the economic crisis. And in Germany, do we want the German example? Are we, you know, reassured by this? And finally, just to tell you why I'm so disturbed, why I'm so distressed. I would have thought, I was hoping that the deployment of the 1st Brigade was really, you know, maybe he'll intimidate protesters just to discourage turnout on the election day. But Representative Brad Sherman, who is from California, said on C-SPAN.
Want me to read it?
Please.
The only way they can pass this bill, meaning the bailout, is by creating and sustaining a panic atmosphere. That atmosphere is not justified. Many of us were told in private conversations that if we voted against this bill on Monday, that the sky would fall, the market would drop 2,000 or 3,000 points the first day, another couple of thousand the second day, and a few members were even told that there will be martial law in America if we voted no. That's what I call fear-mongering.
So what you need to know is that before the president had the 1st Brigade, that's 3,000 to 4,000 warriors, at his direct command, that threat would have been empty. So why is the 1st Brigade deployed? If for no other reason, if this is true, and I have no reason to believe that Brad Sherman is delusional, though as a journalist I would need a second source to confirm it, one thing we know it does is make a threat like that effective.
I'm going to read something that happened today.
Oh, you've thanks.
Been, you've been you've been on planes and you've been in busy. Sarah Palin in Clearwater, Florida, at the beginning of the day, and I'm quoting this from Dana Milbank, the Washington Post columnist and former reporter. As you probably know, that campaign, especially Palin, is using the alleged closeness of Bill Ayers, a founder of the Weathermen, to say that Obama is, well, Palin says, according to the New York Times, He was Ayers was a domestic terrorist and part of a group that, quote, launched a campaign of bombings that would target the Pentagon and our U.S. Capitol. Boo, the crowd repeated. Kill him, proposed one man in the audience. It doesn't say who the him was,
right.
But it is the case that she did not respond to that.
Well, I can tell you who I think the him probably was. One of the classic things, a would-be dictator, a gang of criminals seizing power, will often do is use agents provocateurs, which means agents of the state who dress like Republican citizens or dress like protesters, dress like anarchists, and serve an outcome. For instance, at the RNC, here was a tip-off. There were reportedly hundreds, like 200 men in black wearing balaclavas, linking arms and engaging in menacing behavior, posing as anarchists. I've been on the left for 30 years. You cannot get three lefties to wear a t-shirt, you know, to the same, you know, the same t-shirt to a protest. These were not our guys. You know, we are not that disciplined. Actually, a reporter for, he asked me not to name his newspaper, a very respected newspaper, told me on background that people were photographing the police in St. Paul and that people who were those same guys showed up as infiltrators and provocateurs. So one thing that I realized when you were speaking that has turned my stomach into knots is that the Patriot Act broadly expands the definition of terrorist. And, you know, in Minnesota, the State Patriot Act also broadly expands the definition of terrorist. What I'm afraid, I just realized they're setting up, is if the United States, is told there's a state of emergency, or, I mean, the question I asked, and these are serious questions, is, okay, bear with me. This is so, I just feel like I need a Valium for this, but what they've done, and this is typical, Stalin did this, Hitler did this, you know, all the dictators do it, is they create a category of terrorist or saboteur or, you know, spy or enemy of the people, right? And then whoever associates with the saboteur, the terrorist, the spy, the enemy of the people has guilt by association, and that gets criminalized. Then they become a terrorist or a spy. And so I'm worried about her saying it's his associations, because the very horrible thing I have to tell you is that the Bush lawyers have argued and made the claim that in the war on terror, the whole world is a battlefield, right? And anyone around the world can be named an enemy combatant and taken out in various ways. So now we have troops on the ground in America. If the whole world is a battlefield, is America not a battlefield? And if America is a battlefield, which law prevails, military law or civilian law? And he's created loopholes in the Insurrection Act so that he can pretty much say, well, you're insurgents. I haven't looked at the language for terrorists, but that's expanding. And my fear is Barack Obama, associate of terrorists, Barack Obama, associate of insurgents. And the First Brigade has the power to arrest anyone under President Bush's command.
In a moment, we're going to take questions. I just wanted to ask you one more, and that is, we are having this conversation now, and you are saying everything you want to say, and this room contains people who can also say whatever they want to say. You have demonstrated that in dictatorships, elections do happen. You have not been intimidated from speaking out, even if we have a surveillance society. We are not forbidden from having this conversation.
Right. That's a very important question, and I'm glad you asked it. Thank you. There's a misconception that we and, you know, raised in democracies have about how a democracy closes down. It's rare that a modern state that's a democracy will close down in a violent coup. Usually it closes down like this, a series of tipping points. And so very often in Germany in 30, 31, 32, there would be discussions like this all the time I mean, while this editor was being beaten, you know, by the brown shirts, universities were having debates about the regime. And while, you know, in Italy in 1920, while these black shirts were intimidating the voters in Milan, you know, the people were writing editorials or having, you know, panel discussions, you know, in another part of Italy. And what happens is that, I mean, actually in Germany, you know, people would be sitting in a room like this, and then just like at the University of Florida, someone would stand up and ask a question about the regime or about the National Socialists, and they would be dragged out, you know, by the SA in the audience. Informally, the SA was still illegal to torture people at that time. It was still a democracy. And you saw how people reacted at the University of Florida. This kid was tasered by police. By the way, the University of Florida is answerable to many people close to Jeb Bush, right? We were talking about pressure from the legislature on public universities. And everyone else just sat there. Stunned. This was totally a scene from Germany in 1930-31.
This was the don't taser me,
don't
bro.
Don't tase me, bro. So what I want to say is that when I say it closes down like this, what I mean is things look really normal, and then the state will legalize torture. And then we'll get used to that, and things look really normal. And then, you know, Bill Keller will be told you should be charged with treason for publishing the Swift banking story. And then we'll get used to that. And then things will look really normal. And then Jane Hampshire and Amy Goodman will be, you know, brutally arrested at the RNC. And then we'll get used to that. And then there's this moment, and it's always the same moment, when people at the heart of civil society, journalists, editors, opposition leaders, labor leaders, and outspoken clergy are arrested. And then after that happens, and, you know, often they're released or they face some kind of abuse in prison. They're not always, like, murdered the way they were by Pinochet. But after that happens, you will still have all the structures of free society standing, but people will shut down. That's what happened in April 1933 in Germany. So you're saying to me, I'm here, I'm still speaking. And I'm saying to you, I am terrified. And I have good reason to be terrified. And I worry about my kids every minute of the day. And I don't want to be here. And I, you know, I'm past my deadline. Because last fall I said, when I see someone I identify with, like a journalist, being named an enemy combatant or charged facing 10 years under the Espionage Act, it's at that point I'll stop speaking because I'll be too scared. Well, at the RNC, you know, Jane Hampshire was put face down by agents of the state who burst
from
in
Fire
armed,
Dog Lake.
FireDogLake.com, her arms shackled behind her. You know, mass arrests, and 100 people were charged for conspiracy to riot, felony charges. So I'm past my deadline. I'm past what I promised myself as a mother. Well, you know, but yes and no. No, yes and no, because what I'm trying to tell you is in a closing society, when they go after people's children, then even brave people go quiet. So for the first time in my life, my brave and lovely daughter Rosa turned to me as I was about to come out on this book tour and said, why would you criticize the government if you have children? An American child said this because this is what she has grown up knowing. All right? Now, I'm talking, but here's why I'm talking. First of all, we are not safe. There's probably, it's not that big a crowd, but it's very possible that there's an infiltrator here tape recording this conversation. And you're safe now, but when the troops are deployed, you know, I'm quite sure that, you know, if there's going to be, you know, if they're going to go down the list, I'm on that list. Do I want to be on that list? No. Why am I talking? It's because I know the nature of a closing society. It is far, if there's safety, there is not safety in silence. This is for sure. It is utterly clear from my study of closing societies that the only hope for us is in all of us acting together. And that's true for me as well. That's why I'm here, because this is my lifeline. I'm like throwing this out to you guys and saying, let's construct a raft. I need you, because otherwise we are, as Ben Franklin said, if we don't hang together, we will surely hang separately. Now, more positively, you know, I just want to share, I'm Jewish and I live in New York, so I have a shrink. And
some people here of all persuasions.
You know, it's a bi-coastal thing. And I was telling my therapist how frightened I was of going out with the last book. And he said, knowing what, and how frightened I was for my children. And he said, knowing what you know of closing societies, are you safer, are they safer if you speak out now or if you stay silent? And I know that of these two unpleasant alternatives, you know, our silence does not protect us. For sure, you can be the best Republican on the planet, you can be an evangelical. I've just written an open letter to conservatives saying, you think you won't like a Barack Obama presidency, you will not like a police state. Because again and again, dictators turn on their own. They purge their own. Stalin did it, Hitler did it, Night of the Long Knives. There is no safety in a police state. So yeah, I'm here, but do I feel the freedom that I felt before, knowing the kinds of jeopardy that's ahead? Am I thinking every day, am I being a good mother by doing this? Those are not thoughts an American should have.
I can't help asking this since you mentioned your shrink.
But are you crazy? No, I'm sorry.
Well, it's not far from the question I'm going to ask.
Sure.
If your shrink...
Go ahead, bring it on.
Has your shrink... Would your shrink say to you, I think you may be paranoid. I think you may see conspiracies where there are none.
Can I ask you something? Given what I've told you, would your shrink say you may be in denial?
I go by a rule that you're either in denial or in recovery.
Well, I guess I'm in recovery. I think the definition of paranoia, and it's certainly one to, you know, assess. You guys should be assessing, is this woman crazy or not? Does this sound plausible or not? Does she have good grounding? Are there 200 footnotes in this book? Is everything sourced? Are there 200 footnotes in her last book? Is everything sourced? When she blogs, does she provide sources? Is she trained, behaving rigorously as a journalist, as a documentarian? You guys decide, okay? And, you know, I do have a reputation that precedes me for 7 impeccably sourced books, okay? So I believe the definition of paranoia is when you think something's happening, but it's not. And everything I've told you is happening. I'm not saying I know the first brigade will be used against citizens. I'm saying something very objective. My study of closing societies indicates that that's what always happens. So you can decide if you want to take a bet on us being the lucky ones, the first time in history it'll never happen. I think that's foolish. And I also feel like we have an obligation to the founders. And by the way, if I'm paranoid, they were paranoid, right? Because they wrote the Bill of Rights and the Constitution in a state of absolute fear, the kind of fear I'm feeling. Because they didn't think, oh, these people will enjoy this blessing of democracy forever, and they can just snooze about it, and they don't have to lift a finger to protect democracy. The founders knew that a tyrant, an oppressor, what they called a despot, would arise in America to oppress Americans unless the people were vigilant. They categorically knew, I said this before, that if we did not protect these checks and balances, exactly what they faced with George III would arise again. That's the mood in which they drafted the Constitution and the Bill of Rights. So I would much rather, as a patriot, err on the side of alerting citizens to these historical patterns and letting them decide for themselves and take the action appropriate to them. And if you guys want to make fun of me, you're welcome to, because may that be the worst of our problems.
That's an invitation to you. Do some of you have questions? And I'm going to echo what Louise said. Please, if you have a speech, make it in the form of a question. Right here down the front.
Thank you. The First Brigade coming out, compliments of an economic crisis that's upon us, possibly. I don't know about that, but I am sure that if there was a terrorist attack, they would come out. And I think the people would give everything away immediately for their safety. And after that, obtaining those rights back may be very difficult. Bruce Ackerman, I think, at Yale.
Yeah.
You know the book, Before the Next Attack.
Yeah.
He proposes an emergency constitution. And is there anything along those lines, maybe not that, but something along those lines where that we're going to be able to use to, if something catastrophic happens, actually come back from where we undoubtedly will go?
Right. That's a very good question. And I actually draw on Bruce Ackerman's work in my chapter on deliberation, because it's his model of deliberation that I use. Before I answer your question, I want to add one last piece of information about the last question, which is this. One reason I'm kind of going, listen, so urgently, is that I know what happens when the tipping point is reached. And what happens is that there's no longer the time, we're no longer in democracy time. In other words, we don't have time to deliberate. We don't have time to pressure our representatives. We don't have time to even process what's happening. I mean, Naomi Klein makes this point, and you see it again and again in history. People are in shock. They can't believe this has happened. Wait a minute, this is America again. But they're so, they go into survival mode. And what people are closing down democracies know is that there's a point at which things start to happen very fast. Okay, so I'm telling you in advance, because we will not have time to say, gee, that Naomi Wolf, maybe she was right. Let's have a panel discussion about it. You know, it'll be just like this. And once that point is reached, there really is no easy going back. So now to your very good question. I did not include any information about an emergency constitution, but I encourage you to consider that the fact that we're even thinking along those lines means that we've been very successfully conditioned or brainwashed to move to a place that we shouldn't be. This country has faced many, many crises with the constitution the founders gave us. And we've been conditioned to think, well, 9/11 changed everything. You know, I have news for you. 9/11 was the first time we were attacked on our landmass, you know, Pearl Harbor, that we were attacked by, you know, the United States was attacked. But this happens to democracies all over the world, you know, and they deal with it, and they remain democracies. So we've been conditioned that this changes everything. The army has to come out. You know, people, look at Madrid. They had a catastrophic, horrific terrorist attack. And they said, democracy is what will protect us best. And they went right back to, you know, a free society, and they went right back to trying the worst of the worst. You know, the people who are, many of them innocent, languishing in Guantanamo, we can't even get news reports of what's happening to them. You know, they can't even see the evidence against them. Spain tried these guys in open civil court and put the testimony on the internet. England, the same thing. Israel, the same thing. Israel faces terrorist attacks again and again and again. And they keep carrying on, you know, at least for Israelis, with a robust democracy, with free speech, with elections, with newspapers, with the judiciary. It is bullshit that, you know, a terrorist attack, you know, needs to change our form of government. Now, if there's like a catastrophic nuclear attack, we need really good, you know, emergency recovery plans. But what, unfortunately, the president has done is create succession of government, continuity of government plans that he won't even show the people on the commission. So this is not okay. I mean, what I'm calling for is to recognize that we're in a true emergency, not a hypothetical one, not wait for the other shoe to drop. And I'm calling for the immediate impeachment and then arrest of the President of the United States of America and the criminals. And by the way, I mean, those of you who are Republican or independent, you have a very important role, because this has to be a bipartisan effort, and also morally it should be a bipartisan effort. Yeah.
More hands. Libby, down here. Oh, great.
You brought up continuity of government, and I believe that's co-president Cheney's brilliant idea. When we have roughly, I think, 30,000 lobbyists putting money in.
Wow. You need to speak up, because the mic just went off. Please.
Okay. When we have 30,000 lobbyists putting money into the pockets of our congressmen, how can we, you know, how can we get to the point where
this corrupt government that we have, how can we really, I'm getting the idea from you that we start with 20 and 30 people,
right,
but we're dealing against tens of thousands of corrupt politicians.
Right.
How many do you think it's going to take to take the government back?
Well, it's a very good question. What he said that you might not have heard is, when we're up against 30,000 lobbyists, you know, how can my suggestion about 20 or, you know, groups of 20 or 30 make a difference? it's not the 20 or 30 alone. The national referendum will break the back of the special interests in certain key ways because it literally changes the game plan so that they can't have the influence that they do now. But I'm actually talking about a psychological change. Let's talk about district attorneys. Vincent Bugliosi wrote a fantastic book. Yeah, so great. In which he pointed out that he laid out an impeccable case for the prosecution of George Bush for murder of the soldiers who died in the war. And he made a case for allowing any district attorney from a region where a soldier has died to bring charges against the president. And I actually am in touch with, I'm going to be calling him back, Vincent Bugliosi, to figure out how we move this forward. Yes, please applaud. Oh, right.
And he said, you must understand that if it's brought by any family member...
It's a civil prosecution.
Right.
He said, what I'm after with the Attorney General of Vermont is to bring a criminal prosecution.
Exactly.
And he compared this to the O.J. Simpson case.
Exactly. So what I'm seeing, this interview I did about the deployment has gone viral as of yesterday. And what I'm seeing is people are using it to call on their district attorneys to do exactly this. So what I learned from vigorous democracies is that no matter, like, how did the special interests get to be so entrenched? We abdicated. We left our seat at the table. We, you know, there was 30 years of messaging, government is broken, the parties are the same, there's no point, and then we left the table and the parties became the same and government was thus broken because we gave up our power. We bought into it. We left. So I'm saying something that can't be summed up in a soundbite, but when every single citizen in a closing society, look at Pakistan, nobody said, well, we've got to do this, 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 and this in a coherent game plan. There was some broad outlines. We've got to restore the judiciary. We've got to protest. You know, all the lawyers and judges have to come out. But what happened was thousands and thousands of ordinary Pakistanis said, I'm not going to tolerate it. And they said no at every level. Same thing with citizens in many closing societies. Look at Eastern Europe. Citizens poured out in Estonia. They were forbidden to sing their national anthem. And so many thousands and thousands and thousands of Estonians came out to sing the damn anthem that there weren't enough, you know, bullies and secret police to arrest them all. And then they linked arms across three countries standing in the road and blocking traffic. Three countries. And this helped bring down the Soviet Union. So I can't tell you every single thing that every one of you and your friends will find yourselves called to, I would say, by a higher purpose. But that's just me. And I'm not proselytizing to you. But I believe we're here for a reason. And I don't know in which place you'll find your crossroads. Do I cave, do I yield, or do I stand up and say no? Do I act as a patriot? But I know from history that when millions of people in their own, these police at the RNC, there were Vietnam War vets, no, Iraq War vets who were protesting the war, and the police were tasked with arresting them, and they refused to do it. So I'm calling on families of the military in the 1st Brigade. I'm calling on the soldiers. I'm calling on the generals. I'm calling on the district attorneys. But I'm calling on all of you because up and down the chain of command, when citizens say no, they cannot enforce their will.
Other hands. Over on the aisle there, the person that, yes, ma'am.
The presidential directive of May 9th, he says that basically, if some catastrophe happens, which he doesn't even have to define, we have martial law. The president and the office of the vice president are in charge, and there's no mention of the Senate, the Congress, the judiciary. It's crazy. Yeah. Is that legal? Is that that's a script that he wrote? This
right.
is all following very stepwise, and
right.
it was not well publicized.
No. I have to say, I know a lot of people in the mainstream media, and I am baffled at how they can get away just simply not covering these events. Has anyone read about the deployment of the 1st Brigade in the press? I mean, I gather CNN just reported that they will be deployed. They haven't reported that they have been deployed. Yeah. You're quite right about that presidential directive. It's appalling. And my question to you is, you know, what's logical? Is it logical to assume that these people would put all this effort into, like, laws that looking backward, indemnify people from war crimes and torture if they're not going to torture? Is it likely that they would put all this effort into continuity of government efforts, these directives, if they're never going to use them? The guy is going to be going home, theoretically, in 3.5 months. Why does he need the 1st Brigade, right? So you're quite right to be concerned about this. Now, this is where Nazi Germany is such an incredibly rich lesson. Everything they did was legal. Everything they did was legal because they started to write the laws to make it legal. And because 1 month, April of 1933, Goebbels did what Karl Rove tried to do with the U.S. attorneys. He purged the judges and the lawyers so that all the judges and lawyers in Germany would be aligned with the regime. And if they weren't, they would get aligned because they knew what would happen to them. And then everything that preceded was illegal, and laws proliferated making it illegal for you, if you're German, to have a Jewish girlfriend, and if you're Jewish, it's illegal for you to show the German flag, and, you know, it's illegal to help Jews who are getting rounded up or persecuted, and it's legal to take their possessions. Every damn thing that happened was legal. So this is why we're in such a crisis. It's not as if you can say to the 1st Brigade, well, these are illegal orders because they're now legal. But this is why we need to be mindful, we need to be careful. We, you know, it takes a national movement now to rise up and step in and say, criminals, there's been a coup, criminals are at the helm, arrest them, get them behind bars. According to the historical blueprint, that is the only safe thing to do. You cannot wait. Yeah.
Yes, the gentleman right in front of you, did you have a question?
I promise to answer your question when I'm chatting with people afterwards.
Okay, yeah. Great. Sir?
Ms. Wolf.
Yes.
I appreciate you very much for bringing up these hard, stubborn things that John Adams called facts, no matter how difficult they may be.
Thank you.
And I think that your daughters, you have...
Daughter.
Your daughter and your son, they are going to know in the future what their mother did to protect them.
Thank you.
They're going to know.
Thank you. I hope so.
Yeah. And at the very least, she did everything that she could.
Thank you, but can I just say something?
Yeah.
My daughter and my son are going to be a lot better off if all of you and all of your daughters and sons join me.
Amen. And I would like to make a quick point and a proposal to you and get your reaction to it.
Thank you.
I watched that video that you just recorded up, I think it was in Seattle, and you mentioned a word that I've been grilling Congress members for more than a year now to try to get them to say it, which is treason. And you said it, and you defined it perfectly. You said that in the midst of this bailout, we've been threatened. We now have, they are openly violating posse comitatus as they've stripped habeas corpus over the last years. And this, you know, no matter whether there's terrorists out there that can threaten our bodily our security, everyone that is in office and in the military took an oath to defend the Constitution against all enemies, foreign and domestic.
Right.
So I think that word is crucial. And so
you need to ask your question because I know that
okay.
Other people...
So the proposal is that a group of us this last July delivered a paper to a federal judge in downtown L.A. here accusing both the executive branch and now the legislative branch of treason in the criminal cover-up of the 9/11 attacks.
Uh-huh.
But it doesn't just have to be about 9/11. And so my proposal is that in addition to the murder cases, we, the people of the United States of America, know that there's treason, misprision of treason declares that we have to put these facts in front of all the governors of every single state, all the federal judges we can, and including the DAs.
Right. Okay. Thank you very much. I mean, that's quite right. I've been thinking a lot about treason. It's tricky in the constitutional definition because it, as I understand it, it defines treason as someone acting on behalf of a foreign government, and these people are acting on behalf of basically themselves and Halliburton. But I agree with you that treason is something to investigate with my lawyer friends, and I'll actively consult them more intensively.
No, I'm sorry. We're going to have to move on.
We have to move
Last question, please. Right here in the front.
But,
oh, sorry.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you so much. I wanted to ask you if you know if there's any merit, and I do appreciate Everything that you're doing, I really appreciate it. And I wondered if there's any merit in a campaign to our representatives. What would be the first things that we would tell them if we could get everybody mobilized across the country to go to the reps?
Right. Very, very good question. A wonderful one to end on, because it goes back to the theme of the evening, which is the power and responsibility we all have. I've talked about all the dark things we're facing, but I really want to kind of end our conversation here, although I hope we have many more in the future. And all of you, by the way, go to myamericaproject.org. This is our national effort to enlist our army of citizens to take action, whether it's watching the polls, organizing people to address their representatives, putting pressure on DAs, and so on in this crisis. And also, you should know that if you want to spread the word and get your neighbors and friends who don't read books to understand in an easy way what's at stake and time to act, there's a film that's been cut based on The End of America, and you can go to theendofamericamovie.com and download it and show it to your friends and neighbors, or pre-order it so that you can, you know, alert them in an easy way to take action certainly before the election, or before anything happens. What can you do? What should you be saying to your representatives? I think self-interest is powerful. And tomorrow there will be a blog that I'd like to direct you to that'll point out to them that they can be arrested by the First Brigade. And, you know, that will freak them out. And what you need to do is to go to your, I would say go in person to your district office of your representative with... they only, by the way, pay attention to registered voters who vote. I learned this. So all your friends who are registered voters, get them to, you know, sign your statement committing all of these citizens to a course of arrest and, you know, impeachment first, and then arrest and prosecution. They need to impeach him immediately in a bipartisan effort. And also, I would say start an escrow account, because money talks, and say that all of you are withholding money from your representatives. It's all going into this escrow account until you take legal action, and until they direct the DAs to arrest, to press charges. This is a sort of too little too late, though, because all of this will take a lot of time. You need to do it, but I think most importantly, you need to get the word out, and you need to say and phrase it like this: what is name of representative doing about this, and telling people do not support this politician unless he or she steps up in this time of crisis. And you need to write the op-ed, you need to go on television, you need to use the radio, and you need to use the internet as well to spread the word and run this campaign. I beg your pardon, it's going to be posted either on Huffington Post or Alternate tomorrow, and it's basically letting people know what the First Brigade can do and what they can do to Congress.
It's been a troubling conversation. It's also, believe it or not, been hopeful.
I'm glad to hear that.
Please join me in thanking Naomi Wolf.
Thank you.
Aloud Audio is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through the generosity of the law firm Arendt Fox. Additional support is provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, City National Bank, KPMG, contributors to the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and Donna and Martin J. Wolf. Media support provided by KCRW 89.9 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and KCET. Aloud theme composed by David Ornette Cherry.